Satanism today on the 9 Cents Podcast. This is Magister David Harris.
Welcome to this relaunch of Satanism Today. Here as part of the 9 Cents Podcast, I am Magister David Harris. I want to start by extending a heartfelt thanks to Reverend Campbell for allowing me to be a part of his fine show, and to extend thanks to the staff of the 9 Cents Podcast for welcoming me and for picking up the ball where I put it down when I stopped doing Satanism Today. What the staff of this show has done really has extended what I set out to do by leaps and bounds. And I only hope that in some small way I can continue to contribute to what Reverend Campbell calls furthering the greater satanic conversation. On this month's episode of Satanism Today, what we're going to be talking about, something that I found to be very, very impressive. There's been a lot of talk in the media about people co-opting our name, using the name Satan to further their own agenda. Whether that agenda be to put a few bucks in their pocket, garner some attention from the mainstream media, or what have you. One thing they are not doing is representing Satanism. These people are the very definition of frauds, of fakes, phonies. People who choose to use the devil's name, but really fall short of playing the devil's game. What we're going to be presenting to you here today is an example of somebody who really and truly uses the devil's name and plays the devil's game to perfection. Someone who worked within the confines and the constructs of the world in which we live and won. In 2012, my guest, Reverend Lee Kroll, took to the court system, the Commonwealth of the state of Virginia, and fought of his own volition for the right for satanic clergy to engage and perform legal wedding ceremonies in the state of Virginia. This is key and paramount in the fight for true acceptance of Satanism as a religion and of Satanism as a legitimate philosophy within the United States of America. When other people are sitting there trying to pull off publicity stunts, Reverend Kroll went into the system head first, took the system on, and beat it. When other so-called pseudo-Satanists are fucking around with statues, Reverend Kroll changed a statute. And we're going to be talking with Reverend Kroll about what he did 3 years ago in 2012. When we come back, this is Satanism Today on the 9 Cents Podcast. And welcome back to Satanism Today. I am Magister David Harris, and I'm here on the phone with Reverend Lee Kroll. Lee, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. Thank you for having me on.
Good, good. Now, just to give a little bit of background about why you're on the show today. Back in 2012, a court decision was made in the Commonwealth of Virginia allowing priests and members of the hierarchy of the Church of Satan to legally officiate weddings within the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia. And you were responsible for that. You were the one who picked up the mantle and took on this fight. And we're awfully, awfully proud of you for doing it. And we're going to sing your praises and talk about it today.
Well, it definitely wasn't a mantle that I thought was going to be a fight. But, you know, anticipating how our organization is viewed by the general public, I set the groundwork for knowing that it could be a long and protracted legal battle.
Now, Let's talk about the events that led up to you ultimately petitioning the court for this rite. Had you been approached by members of the church to officiate a wedding? Or was this something?
I had not. No, not at that time. But after being elevated and ordained a minister with the COS, I thought it was only necessary to take the necessary steps to make sure the legal steps and the paperwork was in place in the event that someone did approach me so that it could be seamless.
So in other words, you saw this as something that may become an issue down the road should you be called upon to officiate a wedding.
Correct. I mean, I take my, you know, my ordination and the responsibilities as a reverend within the CUS very seriously. And knowing that those of us who are above ground are very few and far between. And so making myself available to those that wanted to actually have somebody legally officiate a marriage, I wanted to make sure that I was available for that.
Now, from the onset, what kind of opposition were you met with prior to the hearing?
Well, similar to what we're seeing a lot in the news now with the gay marriage issue, and with any bureaucracy, you show up to the courthouse or the clerk's office to fill out the paperwork to get a minister's license. And just like with any bureaucracy, you have to fill out the paperwork and answer a few questions. You're never approached with the people that are in charge. It's always staff people or lesser functionaries. And you can imagine the look on the staff person's face when I filled out the paperwork and standing there looking like Bill Nye the Science Guy with a happy grin on my face and slide the paperwork across the table. And she looks at me and says, hold on just one moment, please, and disappears into the back.
Yeah, because this was going on in Virginia. You're essentially in the heart of the Bible Belt. I imagine this was a little off-putting to some of the folks you may have encountered in the court system.
Well, definitely off-putting. And, you know, this is a very large Baptist community in the area in which I lived. I mean, it is the capital city. It is Richmond, Virginia. But you still have, you know, not only the educational and the religious, you know, barriers on trying to push a legal issue, but most staff people are trained in this very rote fashion on how to process paperwork, and they see the same things all the time. And when things are out of the ordinary, they are not charged with making any decisions themselves.
Right. They've got all of this bureaucracy and red tape they have to go through before a decision can even be made.
Correct.
Now, at the time that you began this struggle, how public were you about your affiliation with the church?
Oh, I've been very public with my affiliation with the church, even before I was ordained as a reverend within the COS. From even as the job I have now, everyone in both my staff and my supervisor knows that I'm a reverend in the Church of Satan.
And they've never given you any static about it?
No, I've discovered that in the type of work that I do, in the legal profession I do, when you make people a lot of money, whether it's my sexual orientation or my religious affiliation, when you bring in millions of dollars for people, they don't really give a damn.
And that's how it should be. Now, on a personal level, as you began to take on this fight, what kind of support were you getting from the outside, from friends, families, loved ones?
As far as getting my minister's license within Virginia?
Yeah.
That issue really wasn't brought to the forefront as far as no one really knew that it was going on, because I didn't really want to make a lot of press or a lot of hay out of it. It was just for my purposes, and I think for the COS administration, we were just going through the legal process, and we knew we were going to come out at the end triumphant. At least I felt confidently of that. It wasn't about making press releases and getting the ACLU involved and, you know, stirring up a lot of controversy.
Right. So this was definitely more about the moral implications and less about making waves publicly, with regards to this issue.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say moral implications. I think that's exactly why that first barrier was placed in front of me, is because there was some moral hesitation about licensing somebody from the Church of Satan. I was approaching it more from the legal standard and the constitutional rights issue.
Now, let's get into the procedural process that you had to go through. Now, if I'm understanding correctly, what this actually was, you petitioned the court for a hearing to allow you to do this. Now, what does that mean to the layman who may not understand the legal system?
Okay, so once my application with the clerk was denied, I had to petition the court, which means I had to file under Virginia law to have a judge overrule the clerk and issue my minister's license on behalf of the Commonwealth of Virginia. So either the clerk can do it in a perfunctory way, which is how most people get it done, or if the clerk refuses, then the judge has the authority to do so.
And now the legal statute, as I read through some of the documentation that you had provided to me, Code 2023 states that within the Commonwealth of Virginia, someone petitioning for a minister's license must provide proof of ordination within a religious organization, as well as be shown to have being in regular communion with the congregants of that organization. Now, proof of ordination, it's pretty straightforward. You know, those of us who are members of the hierarchy, you know, have proof of ordination from the church. Within the construct of the Commonwealth of Virginia, constitutes being in regular communion with your congregation? And how would one perceive, let's say, what Christian churches do as opposed to what we do as the definition of communion?
Well, interestingly enough, the judge didn't actually get to that question until probably the second hearing. But the regular communion aspect is derived from a case called Kramer versus the Commonwealth, and your listeners can easily find that case on Google Scholar. The citation is 214 VA 561, and that case is really the heart of the precedential issues involved in establishing the test for the court. And in Kramer versus Commonwealth, regular communion, the court determined, was basically mutual participation or joint and common action. The court stays away in its legal analysis in that case all the way back from 1974, not using the term communion in the ecclesiastical sense, which is what, you know, most people think of when they think of communion. They think of Catholicism.
Right.
The court focuses more on communion as in people coming together for a common purpose. And we know from the COS perspective, our purpose routinely has been the pentagonal revisionism and seeing that those five items manifest.
Mm-hmm. And so now, what did you have to present to the court to establish that as a sign of being in regular communion, as opposed to, let's say, you know, Christian churches who just simply get together and congregate every Sunday?
Well, the difficult concept for the judge was the fact that the COS doesn't have brick-and-mortar buildings and regular weekly meetings. That was a difficult concept for the court to understand. And I had to rely heavily on the social networking aspects of our organization and the regional cabals that get together on a regular basis, whether it's holidays or special events. What makes it difficult to sort of argue that communion for the judge is because so many of us have this sort of misanthropic, you know, the myth of the satanic community flowing through our organization and our church. but I was able to pull upon so many of the events that have occurred all the way back from the letters to the devil's days and current social networking aspects that we have to communicate and get together and commune with one another, that the judge accepted that argument.
Now, you had initially been met with some resistance from the judge. In addition to that, he had asked you about precedent.
Correct. Well, there was two main issues there. The first hearing on precedent was whether or not the Church of Satan was actually a religion. We spent probably the first hearing of probably 40 minutes going through the tests the U.S. Supreme Court and the Tenth Circuit established what the testing and the holdings are in order to determine whether the COS actually was a religion and not just a group of heretics and shit disturbers like so many other groups that we can probably think of. But the other test of precedent was toward the end, and where the judge was sort of hesitant to be out on a limb on his own in this area of the country and say, acknowledging that I probably had the law on my side, but didn't want to be the one to say, yes, Chief Judge Taylor is the one that issued a minister's license to a Satanist. And so he asked me at one hearing towards the end, well, has any other jurisdiction or court issued a license to marry to a Church of Satan member? And at the time, I said, well, I'll put together another brief, and I'll get back to you.
And what were your findings there?
Well, I was able to, with the help of the administration, pull together enough documents to show that the Church of Satan had been performing marriages from Anton LaVey himself back in 1967 in California, and even as conservative of states as Kentucky in 1971 by other members of the church at the time.
Mm-hmm. And so precedent didn't really need to be established in this case because other states were already just simply allowing members of, you know, priests in the church to officiate weddings legally.
Yes, that is correct. But the challenge I had with establishing that for the record was that because of the age of those cases, the court's record retention policies had destroyed all of the records.
Right.
So the judge had to take my word for it.
Right. And so were you met with resistance from the judge on that point?
No. I was able to have an opportunity to present some newspaper references to it, but not necessarily legal court documents that show that it did occur. So I had persuasive evidence, but not necessarily factual evidence for the court to review.
But ultimately, that evidence was accepted as being some form of evidence that these weddings had occurred in a legal fashion. And ultimately, the judge did find in your favor.
Well, it's interesting that aspect is because at the last hearing, when the judge said he had reviewed all the briefs I had filed and considered all the testimony, but at the bench when he gave his oral decision, he said that he was going to deny my application for a minister's license.
Really?
And it was at that moment, that was the only time during the 2 or 3 month long process and multiple hearings where I lost my cool, and I looked at him and I said, you realize I will win on appeal, Your Honor. And he takes off his glasses and he looks at me. He gives me this look like, you little shit. And I knew, I was like, why did I say that? And he's like, I will issue my written decision for you within the next 10 days. So I left sort of like, okay, well, I anticipated this was going to be a hard road. But now, at that point, I'm angry, right? I'm like, okay, I'm going to take out a second mortgage on my house because this, I'm like, I'm going to win this bastard.
What do you think ultimately, because ultimately you had presented as much proper legal evidence, as much proper, you know, circumstantial evidence that legal ceremonies had taken place, where do you think his opposition came from? Because obviously it wasn't coming from a legal place.
No, I think the opposition was, he was the chief judge in the circuit court, and he was hesitant to put himself out there to, you know, it's such a novel issue for him and for this circuit that he was really nervous about any sort of press that may come out of it and have his name attached to it, which may hamper his ability to be appointed to a higher bench. Yeah.
He didn't want to be the Satan judge is basically what it was.
That's correct. But I think two things I think swayed the judge in the end when he issued his final decision in the COS's favor. And that was, one, throughout the 3 months of testimony, I kept myself in front of that judge using lesser magic by picking up child abuse cases and other pro bono cases so that at least twice a week I was in front of that judge. My face was in front of him all the time.
Oh, he must have hated you.
You know, and so, I mean, the first time he asked me, he's like, we don't have a hearing on your issue today. And I said, no, Your Honor, I'm here representing so-and-so on this other matter. And so what I think that sort of played into my favor is that he could never escape the issue, as much stress as that issue probably caused him. My face and my issue was always in the sinews of every aspect of his life.
So ultimately he found in your favor just to get rid of you.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in that last hearing when he said he was going to deny, I always acknowledge this, is that I also applied greater magic to manifest the victory. And, you know, I need to acknowledge that, because it's a very important aspect of our faith.
Right. And so you purged yourself emotionally and ritualistically to sort of clear your head and focus your energy towards this goal.
Yes, and I think, you know, grabbing a hold of that energy and pushing my decision into him and to see that it, you know, whatever the final written decision would so that it would be in my favor. And when the time came, when the final written decision was there, it came in a simple, small envelope. And I'm like, well, this is odd. If it's a denial, it should be thicker than this. And I opened it up, and all it was my license with his signature. No opinion, no nothing.
No words, nothing, no verbiage that could be attached to the decision, just here.
No, and it is, you could barely understand it, see his signature. It was just a squiggle.
Plausible deniability. He refuses to be the Satan judge.
Yeah. But in the end, you know, going through that, I have to think, you know, was for the whole hearing, I have to say the funniest part of the whole hearing process was the first hearing when I was called. The courtroom's full of people waiting for their cases to be called. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, Mr. Krull, why are you here? Why didn't you just go to the clerk? And I said, well, the clerk said I had to come to you for my license. And he says, well, why is that? And I said, well, I don't believe the court was comfortable with my religious affiliation. And so he looks down at the paperwork and he says, oh. And he says, and he looks at his staff, and they just put their heads down. And he says, well, can you tell me a little bit about your group? And he's trying to be sensitive, I think, because the courtroom is full, and he doesn't want to create a scene.
Right.
And I said, well, I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not sure I understand the question. Do you mean the Church of Satan? And all behind me, everyone's sort of whispering, waiting for the case to be called, and this hush falls over the courtroom. And everyone just, you can see them, I just feel it in the back of my head, like, what the hell did he just say?
You know, every now and again, a little bit of first phase is fun.
Yes. Well, that was the opening salvo. And, you know, 3 months later, there was a victory for our church. So
that's fantastic. Now, going forward, let's talk broad picture.
You know, okay.
This obviously, you know, as tactfully and as very, very intelligently as you fought this battle, this thing has wide implications. I mean, there is now officially, you know, legal precedent on the books in at least one state in this country, you know, where, you know, in other states it may not have been necessary, but there is an absolute concrete on the books record of priests in the Church of Satan being legally allowed to officiate weddings. What kind of implications going forward do you think this will have for the church?
Well, I think it's important for your listeners and other members of our congregation to realize that this victory that we achieved in 2012 could not have been done without folks like yourself and others that have been sticking your necks out for decades, either before and during the Satanic Panic and still today. My victory is only achievable because I'm standing on the shoulders of the accomplishments you guys have already achieved.
Oh, we appreciate that, and we appreciate what you've done with this. This is far and away probably one of the most remarkable victories for Satanism in the public eye. For a legal body to acknowledge the right of our priesthood to officiate weddings of our congregation is nothing short of amazing. And we have you to thank for that. And from the bottom of my heart, and I'm sure from the bottom of the hearts of every member of the priesthood of Mendes, we say thank you, because this is remarkable.
Well, I think going forward, one of the things that, you know, shine some light on those members of the hierarchy and those members that may become elevated in the future, is that the key is to remember that we are a church and we have religious tenets, and our membership is considered a congregation, to continue to speak on these issues and to put ourselves out there as we're not just a group of people getting together as heretics and we hate Christians. We have to continue to push ourselves out there as a legitimate church, and that is what's going to continue to move the line on acceptance in our society, so that more of our members can come above ground and show people that we are the alien elite and the movers and the shakers of the world.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, listeners of Satanism Today on the 9 Cents Podcast, Reverend Lee Krell. Lee, thank you so much for being here with us today and for everything you've done. It's, like I said, it's nothing short of extraordinary, and you are a prime example of what it means to be a Satanist and a priest in this church. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Magister Harris, and hopefully your listeners enjoyed it. It's probably not as exciting as a discussion about vagina time, or it's hilarious, but, you know, hopefully somebody got something out of it.
Lee, thank you very much, my friend. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye-bye.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
And...